There we go.
Give me your cup, I'll go throw it away.
All right, we're ready to get underway. We ended up last time with the end of chapter 28, and so we're going to begin with chapter 29 and finish up 1 Samuel and get into 2 Samuel. The story of David continues.
Pastor, can I have that?
Yeah. Oh, yes. All right. So in chapter 28, Saul is found without God. There's no ephod for him. There's no prophet. There's nothing to tell him what God's will is because he's been, as king, abandoned by God. So he goes to this witch in order to find out what the future holds and what he should do. But all he gets is Samuel, and Samuel tells him that God has abandoned him. So it's a very sad chapter ending. And we're kind of anxious to see what's going to happen in the battle. Because the Philistines are massing against the Israelites. But the chronicler doesn't want to tell us right away. He's much more interested in this contrast between Saul and David. So Saul gets nothing. Then in chapter 29, let's look. The Lord rescues David despite himself. The Philistines gathered all their forces at Aphek, and Israel camped by the spring in Jezreel. So that's where they are, across a valley from one another. As the Philistine rulers marched with their units of hundreds and thousands, David and his men were marching at the rear with Achish. So what is happening is the five cities of Philistia are gathering their forces together, and they're lining up for the battle. And remember that David has gone and he is assisting Achish. The commanders of the Philistine asked, "What about those Hebrews? These Hebrews? Gonna have Hebrews here?" What, you know? Achish replied, "Is this not David, who was an officer of Saul, king of Israel? He has already been with me for over a year, and from the day he left Saul until now, I have found no fault with him." So Achish defends David. The last place David needs to be is fighting against Israel with the Philistines. But the chronicler doesn't tell us anything about, is David worried? What should he do? Or we just don't hear anything. Okay, so what happens? But the Philistine commanders were angry with him and said, "Send the man back. Achish is king of one of the cities." But the other four cities, they're not, "Hey, we're having this Hebrew fighting on our side. That's not a good idea, they don't think. Send the man back that he may return to the place you assigned him. You want him to be your soldier? Then send him back there where he can be your soldier. He must not go with us into battle, or he will turn against us during the fighting. How better could he regain his master's favor than by taking the heads of our own men?" So if he wants to get back in with Saul, he's got a great opportunity here. "Isn't this the David they sang about in their dances? Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." So Achish called David and said to him, "As surely as the Lord lives, you have been reliable, and I would be pleased to have you serve with me in the army. From the day you came to me until now, I have found no fault in you. But the rulers don't approve of you. Turn back and go in peace. Do nothing to displease the Philistine rulers." Go in peace is a phrase that we'll see later on in not too far ahead in 2 Samuel. It's like a, I can't think of the word. When you give someone, not a free pass, safe passage. Like if there's negotiation, we'll give someone safe passage. So you can come and negotiate, we won't attack you.
Asylum
is where you stay. Safe passage is that you can go somewhere safely. All right. So David says, "But what have I done?" David, the guy is giving you your out. Take it and run. I don't know. It's hard to gauge what's exactly happening. But what have I done? Asked David. Maybe he just wants to play this to the very end. What have you found against your servant from the day I came to you until now? Why can't I go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king? So I'm a mercenary and I'm loyal to you, Achish. So anyone's your enemy is my enemy. Achish answered, I know that you have been as pleasing in my eyes as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the Philistine commanders have said he must not go up with us into battle. So Achish doesn't have any choice. The other guys won't go along, so that's it. He must not go up with us into battle. Now get up early, along with your master's servants who have come with you, and leave in the morning as soon as it is light. So David and his men got up early in the morning to go back to the land of the Philistines, and the Philistines went up to Jezreel to fight the battle. And so David's off and running. This is kind of interesting. First of all, you got to see the contrast between the end of chapter 28 and the end of chapter 29. Because in chapter 28, it's night, and Saul's got nothing. In the end of chapter 29, it's daytime, it's the morning. Take your men and go. David is out of there. And it's kind of interesting that he would be delivered, is delivered by the Lord, kind of not against his will is the right word, but to get saved by the Philistines is kind of interesting. Yes?
You almost want to believe the other commanders. That David may have turned on.
Well,
that may have been his intention.
Sure, it could have been his intention.
To fight Saul doesn't make sense. I mean, he had a chance to kill Saul before. Why would you go into battle against him?
Well, more than that, go into battle. I mean, now it isn't about Saul; it's about Israel.
Yeah.
This is right down to it. Yes.
That's why we pray in the Lord's Prayer: is going to keep us from temptation, deliver us from evil. And even when he does that, we still run into it anyway.
It's very possible what Paul is saying, that David intended in the battle to turn and fight for the Israelites. That's very possible. It's hard to know what exactly is happening. At any rate, God gets him out of there. He's going to be king, and I don't think it would have gone well if he had turned against the Philistines in the middle of the battle. He may not have survived. Yes?
Well, I kind of think it must be finding something, because when he was fighting Goliath, he said, you've defied the armies of Israel, God's people.
Well,
Israel would make no sense.
But even if, like Paul's saying, well, maybe he's planning to do this. Well, the next morning he takes off, and Israel's fighting for its life against Philistia, and David's off and running. So I'm not necessarily. David doesn't have to be a plaster saint. You know, someone who never does anything wrong. That's not going to work as we study. Samuel, anyway. Because he's not that. All right.
Chapter 29, I left it out.
Okay. Well, I told a story in the that I read in the outline, top of the second page. Perhaps you've heard the children's story of the Christian woman who was alone and destitute. She prayed to the Lord to deliver her from her predicament. Her atheist neighbor overheard her prayer and decided he would have some fun. He went and bought a couple of loaves of bread and left them on her doorstep. When the woman found the bread, she burst into a devout and grateful prayer of praise. God has delivered her. But her neighbor was determined to rid her of her foolish dependence on a non-existent God. So he informed her that he had overheard her prayer, bought the bread, and put it on her doorstep. It was not God who had answered her prayer, but the woman had the insight of faith. Oh, yes, she said, it was the Lord who answered my prayer, even though he used the devil to do it. So God can even use a Philistine to deliver David. Commentators look at this and they simply don't know what to make of it. You can say that David intended to turn on the Philistines, but if that was his intention, why does he take off and disappear? Why doesn't he just go over to Israel and fight with Israel? Who knows? It's just, and the chronicler doesn't explain it. The chronicler is interested in contrasting Saul and David. That has been the theme all the way through. If you are a believer, then things are going to go well. Whether you think they're going well or not, they're going to go well. If you're not, you're in the dark. You're like Saul out of luck. There is just nothing for you at all. And he wants to tell that. The battle that's going on between Philistia and Israel is kind of a side thing. Saul gets killed. It's important. But it's not the center of the chronicler's story. All right. Let's move on then. Chapter 30. Yes. Oh, yes.
I asked for a backtrack, but I had to leave early last week. With the Witch of Endor, did you discuss at all the calling of the witch of Samuel's spirit?
Yes, we did.
You did, okay.
Well, you know, it's hard to gauge. I mean, can you call up the dead? I think that...
I don't have any idea. You
have to... The chronicler is writing this, not us. He is not writing about witches and ghosts and people who are dead. He's writing about whether Saul can find out, apart from God, what the future holds. Because he can't get the ephod of the priest. There's no prophet. There's no dream. He's cut off from the Lord. That's the chronicler. So to endlessly speculate about whether you can call up the dead or not, I think gets nowhere. Boy, there are endless discussions about it. It's distraction. It makes the story about something that it's not about. So what happened? I don't know. Clearly, God was working in this. You know. So yes.
Well, she called something up, and something appeared, and looks like it was a spirit, but not from.
Well, the chronicler just simply says Samuel said this. I think that it is useless to speculate. I guess you two aren't doing well, huh? I couldn't resist. I'm sorry, Carly. Oh, now she's going to go over there. I'm sorry. No, I think we need to be very, very careful with this. The story is there. God gave Saul a message. But then, does that then mean that ghosts can be called up, or et cetera, et cetera, that witches have power that is equivalent to God, or anything like that? Is just, I think the chronicler would look at you like you were crazy.
Well, it's nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't have any kind of power to hear God, but they do have, there is power.
Yeah, there's the power, one little word can fell them. Yeah, the evil is real. Can someone who is evil call up Samuel? Or is this an illusion? Well, I think no matter what, it's a guess. There's just simply...
So you believe open the possibility it could be Samuel?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I do. I don't think that she had the power to do it. Mm-hmm. I think if it was Samuel, which the chronicler says it was, it's God who's doing this. God is telling him, you're not getting anything, Saul. You've abandoned me and that's it. Yes.
The whole argument, I mean, Jesus himself says that you have to have prayer and fasting to control the demons and the spirits, mm-hmm. and that the power, and what is it, Paul says, the battle is between spirituality and principalities. So the idea that there's the opportunity for an evil spirit to come forth isn't the issue. The question is, was it Samuel? And if God said, send Samuel through this woman's divining...
Well, and look at the example of the demons in Jesus' day who were forced to testify that he was the Son of God. You know,
the woman's obviously distraught because I think in this sense she's surprised she pulled out Samuel.
she wouldn't expect
I think that she was normally hornswoggling people and all of a sudden she's very frightened. Yeah. I think that the story does not give credence to the power of evil. That's not what it is about. Yes.
God is in control of the situation.
Yeah, God is in control of every situation, exactly. Right. All right, let's go to chapter 30. And now it's out of the frying pan into the fire. David and his men reached Ziklag on the third day. So they're marching to their base. Now the Amalekites had raided the Negev and Ziklag. Negev is the south, below the Dead Sea, and east and west. They had attacked Ziklag and burned it, and had taken captive the women and all who were in it, both young and old. They killed none of them, but carried them off as they went on their way. So that's booty. We can sell them as slaves and so forth. When David and his men came to Ziklag, they found it destroyed by fire, and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. Do they know it's the Amalekites? Well, let's see. Either the Lord tells them, or the Lord certainly tells them, but maybe they knew it anyway. So David and his men wept aloud until they had no strength left to weep. They've lost their families, they've lost their homes, they've lost everything. It's hard to feel their pain because the chronicler isn't interested in describing it at length. You know, he just says what is. David's two wives had been captured, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the fool Nabal, of Carmel. David was greatly distressed because the men were talking of stoning him. See, you led us here, and now look what's happened. We should have been with our families instead of being mercenaries for Achish. The men were talking of stoning him. Each one was bitter in spirit because of his sons and daughters. So bad things had happened, very bad things. But David found strength in the Lord his God. See, this is what the chronicler wants us to know. This is why he told this story, I think. David finds strength in the Lord. What did Saul find? Nothing. Then David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, bring me the ephod. See, there's such a contrast between David and Saul. Bring me the ephod. Abiathar brought it to him, and David inquired of the Lord, shall I pursue this raiding party? Will I overtake them? Now, it would seem that it would hardly be a question, right? Should we pursue it? Of course we should pursue it. David says, yeah, okay, maybe I agree with you, but we better ask the Lord. And will we overtake them? Pursue them, the Lord answered. You will certainly overtake them and succeed in the rescue. David and the 600 men with him came to the Besor ravine, where some stayed behind. For 200 men were too exhausted to cross the ravine. Remember, they had done a forced march to get back to Ziklag. And now they're going, so some just are pooed out. But David and 400 men continued the pursuit. They found an Egyptian in a field and brought him to David. They gave him water to drink and food to eat, part of a cake of pressed figs and two cakes of raisins. He ate and was revived. He had low blood sugar, for he had not eaten any food or drunk any water for 3 days and three nights. David asked him, to whom do you belong and where do you come from? He said, I am an Egyptian, the slave of an Amalekite. My master abandoned me when I became ill 3 days ago. We raided the Negev of the Kerethites in the territory belonging to Judah and the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag. So he tells them what they did. And now one gets the impression that the chronicler is telling us that the slave is telling them who did it, and that they really didn't know that, so they're following them, but now they know who did it and exactly what happened. And so how do they know? See, the chronicler would say, the Lord told them. That's why that Egyptian slave was in the field. The Lord is guiding David and his men. So, and it ends up, we burn Ziklag. David asked him, can you lead me down to this raiding party? He answered, swear to me before God that you will not kill me or hand me over to my master, and I will take you down to them. So if I take you down, you kill me, I'm done. You hand me over to my master, I've betrayed them, they'll kill me. I'm not in good shape. So he does the only thing he says, swear to me. And obviously David does that. He led David down, and there they were, scattered over the countryside, eating and drinking and reveling because of the great amount of plunder they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from Judah. So the Negev covers both the south of Judah and the south of Philistia. And what's happening is that the army of Israel and the army of Philistia are getting ready to fight, and these guys are in there doing the best that they can. Boy, things have really gone well. They've got all kinds of slaves. They've got loot, booty. Everything is going well, so they're really smart. They decide to party. And then they partied, and they were reveling because of the great amount of plunder they had taken. David fought them from dusk until the evening of the next day, and none of them got away, except 400 young men who rode off on camels and fled. So some were able to jump up on their camels and get away. Everybody else they killed. David recovered everything the Amalekites had taken, including his two wives. Nothing was missing. Then the Lord had said that. He took all the flocks and herds, and his men drove them ahead of the other livestock, saying, "This is David's plunder." So you got to get that. This is David's plunder. Why does the chronicler tell us that? You have to go back to verse 6. You got to see the structure in what the chronicler is writing. So they're going to stone David because he blew it, and now we followed you, and now all our wives are gone, and our homes are destroyed, and now David's the hero. But in fact, it's the Lord. So David found strength in the Lord. Then David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow him and who were left behind at the Besor Ravine. They came out to meet David and the people with him. As David and his men approached, he greeted them. But all the evil men and troublemakers among David's followers said, "Because they did not go out with us, we will not share with them the plunder we recovered." They were too wimpy, they tuckered out, and now they don't get to share in the booty. However, each man may take his wife and children and go. So you can have your wife and your children, but you can't have any of the flocks and so forth and everything that they recovered. Now the chronicler is telling us how David manages to exercise his kingly power down the line when he starts out with his ragtag band. I mean, this is no wonderful group of people. But David is setting the standards. David replied, "No, my brothers, you must not do that with what the Lord has given us. He has protected us and handed over to us the forces that came against us." So why won't the guys share with the people at the Besor Ravine?
They think it's they that did it, not the Lord. David.
They think that they got this, but David knows that they were going to catch him and that they were going to win because the Lord told him that, and he's listening to the word of the Lord. So you can look at all these. You have to learn to read what's important. So he's telling us this story, but he's really telling us about whether or not we depend on the Lord. The temptation that these 400 had over against the 200 is not anything unusual for human beings. So, "No, my brothers, you must not do that with what the Lord has given us. He has protected us and handed over to us the forces that came against us. Who will listen to what you say? The share of the man who stayed with the supplies is to be the same as that of him who went down to the battle. All will share alike. Who will listen to what you say?" What does that mean? It's David challenging them. Who's going to stand with me, and who's going to stand with the people who don't want to share? And David says, this is the way it is. All will share alike. David made this a statute and an ordinance for Israel from that day to this. It was a principle that went forward. When David arrived in Ziklag, he sent some of the plunder to the elders of Judah, who were his friends, saying, "Here is a present for you from the plunder of the Lord's enemies." Whoa, David's smart. He sees it as a gift from the Lord, not something that he should hang on to. So he uses it to gain favor with everyone. He sent it to those who were in Bethel, Ramoth, Negev, and Jatir, to those who were in Aurora, Sifmoth, Eshtemoa, and Rachel, to those in the towns of the Jerahmeelites and the Kenites, to those in Hormah, Borashan, Athach, and Hebron, and to those in all the other places where David and his men had roamed. And in not a very long time, the elders of Judah are going to declare David king. But it won't be until chapter 5 of 2 Samuel that David becomes king of all of Israel. So this division between Judah and Israel exists. In the days of Solomon, or when Solomon dies, Israel is going to divide. The kingdom is going to divide. Yes?
This is, I can't help but see the analogy where the Amalekites were supposed to be completely destroyed by Saul. And because he failed to do that, the metaphor that the Amalekites equal sin, and the sin does not get dealt with immediately and completely, it carries forward. How much further does the Amalekites continue to harm Israel?
Oh, they're always there.
All the way through.
It's like they and the Edomites.
Yeah.
Herod is an Edomite. Yeah. Israel was supposed to conquer the land. Israel was God's arm. People say the Old Testament God is a terrible God because he's a God of vengeance. Well, the New Testament God is a God of vengeance. If there is no vengeance against evil, then there is no good either. If it makes no difference whether you are in rebellion against God and are pursuing your own interests, because in the end, God's simply going to forgive everyone. You know, he's got a white beard and he's a spiritual Santa, and he'll just say, "Oh, it's all right." You know, and how can a loving God send anyone to hell? How can a loving God not send those who reject him to hell? Otherwise, it makes no difference whether you accept God or reject him. You know, there's not two ways about it. But simple-minded people can't understand that. So, yes, that's a very good point. You know, that was Saul's downfall, the Amalekites. He should have destroyed them. That was the command of the Lord, and he didn't. And now Israel is still paying the penalty. Okay, now we get to chapter 31 and the death of Saul. Now the Philistines fought against Israel. We would have been really interested in this battle. Why doesn't the chronicler get to how things are really going to turn out? What's his story about the Amalekites? But he has a purpose in everything that he says. So what's important to us may not be important to God. That's important to realize. So, now the Philistines fought against Israel. The Israelites fled before them, and many fell slain on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines pressed hard after Saul and his sons to kill the leader. And they killed his sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. The fighting grew fierce around Saul, and when the archers overtook him, they wounded him critically. Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and run me through, or these uncircumcised fellows will come and run me through and abuse me." But his armor-bearer was terrified and would not do it. Maybe because the fear of the Lord, you can't kill the Lord's anointed. There's no motive suggested here, but he won't do it. So Saul took his own sword and fell on it. When the armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he too fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul and his three sons and his armor-bearer and all his men died together that same day. So terrible things for Israel. When the Israelites along the valley and those across the Jordan So Mount Gilboa is right near the Jordan River. They cut off his head and stripped off his armor. Oh, whoops, I jumped, didn't I? Yeah, sorry, from verse 7. When the Israelites along the valley and those across the Jordan saw that the Israelite army had fled and that Saul and his sons had died, they abandoned towns and fled. So all the Israelites along the Jordan Valley were fleeing, and the Philistines came and occupied them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the dead, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head and stripped off his armor, and they sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim the news in the temple of their idols and among their people. Glory be to Dagon, the great god of the Philistine people. They put his armor in the temple of the Ashtaroths and fastened his body to the wall of Beth Shan in English, Beth Shan. If you go to Israel, you're likely to visit Beit Shan. Beit means house, like Beit Lahem, Bethlehem.
Is cutting off his head because it's like retribution for Goliath?
Yeah, but I think that he cut off Goliath's head for the same reason that they cut off his head. It wasn't tit for tat. It's if you cut off the head, you're victorious.
Well, the Philistines had that's a reputation to mutilate bodies. That's why Saul wanted to fall on his sword. Because he knew he was going
to. He didn't want to be captured alive.
Because put your heads on poles and everything else. You know.
Well, that they could do regardless, but they would do worse than that. Right. Okay. When the people of Jabesh Gilead. Now remember, you got to go back. Oh, well, you go back to Jabesh Gilead, and they had problems because they were being attacked. And the guy was so confident he would defeat them that he said, okay, you can take 7 days, you can see what kind of help you can muster. Saul, in his early days, was the hero who rescued Jabesh Gilead. So when the people of Jabesh Gilead heard of what the Philistines had done to Saul, all their valiant men journeyed through the night to Beit Shan. They took down the bodies of Saul and his sons from the wall of Beit Shan and went to Jabesh, where they burned them. Then they took their bones and buried them under a tamarisk tree at Jabesh, and they fasted 7 days. So I don't know what risk they took. It probably was pretty risky to do this, but they felt they owed it to Saul, who had rescued them, so they take the bodies down and they give them a decent burial. And that's it for Saul. Hebrew scroll for Samuel was a single scroll. But when the Hebrew was translated into Greek in the Septuagint, the Greek, like the English, takes many more words. I think I pointed out sometime back, the Hebrew 23rd Psalm has one-third the words of the English. Because they include all kinds of, there's no pronouns, they're all in the verbs. It's just fewer words. That's how we got 1 and 2 Samuel, because there were two scrolls for the Septuagint. And so it's either in 1 Samuel or it's in 2 Samuel. It's just a natural thing. But it's one book, yes.
Is this last statement here sort of, kind of, I don't know what the word is, that God still honors Saul by a proper burial, and even though he was no longer God's anointed, that God made sure that he was chronicled as people still honored him, like
just as David did.
Right.
David had always honored him.
Later on, when John goes and says, "I want the body of Christ off the cross before Passover," and prepares it and gets it out of there.
Yeah. A similar thing. I mean, you always have to be careful. I think that seeing those parallels is a good thing. You just have to be careful what you do with them. If you go beyond anything that the Scripture says, then you're creating a new story or a new doctrine even, or that would be really bad. But But to see these parallels is a natural, right? All right, so now we're moving to 2 Samuel. Yes, George.
You said the chapter of the book was a key part. I thought, didn't they use another apex to
the... Sure, it's the, well... I mean, I shouldn't run and jump. The Masoretic text dates from 1000 AD. But when we have copies of Isaiah and so forth from the Dead Sea Scrolls 1,000 years earlier, there's only four differences. There's only four changes, four words that were changed because of the Dead Sea Scrolls. You may hear something about, well, the Dead Sea Scrolls were really the real Bible. Well, we have the real Bible. And so the Masoretic text is meaningless when the Septuagint was translated. That was something that got its name from later on.
Could you tell?
So they followed the Septuagint or the Masoretic.
Who? The Old Testament follows the Hebrew. Well, the Septuagint is a translation.
Yeah.
Well, you can't follow a translation. Now, where that does matter is when you get into quoting the New Testament. The quotes from the Old Testament that are in the New Testament, they generally come from the Septuagint. Because that's Peter, James, and John didn't know Hebrew very well. It was not their language. Their language was Aramaic, which is related to Hebrew, but isn't Hebrew. So it, for many of the new, and especially when they're writing to anybody who's a Gentile, well, you know, you want the Greek. Now that becomes, there's lots of people who study, that's where the clash between the Masoretic text and the Septuagint comes, in the quotes of the New Testament, not in anything in the Old Testament. So that's a valid point. But the Septuagint wasn't translated from the Masoretic text. That comes later. It's translated from the Hebrew text that they had, which became, as centuries went by, the Masoretic text. And they're the same. They're not different. But the Septuagint is a translation. So, yes?
I think it's interesting. You mentioned these contrasts between David and Saul. Mm-hmm. But the contrast between Samuel and Saul is just as great.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Samuel was, you know, a man that, he was the last judge of Israel, which he dedicated himself to the Lord. And here, the first king of Israel was inconsistent.
Right. We go fairly quickly past Samuel. Samuel was a towering figure. You would think that this book would be named David. Because Samuel didn't write it. But the people back then saw Samuel as the one from whom everything came. And as great as David was, they certainly thought that David was great. They call the book Samuel. Samuel anointed Saul. And Israel, the other thing to remember is that Israel was in a horrible state spiritually. And Samuel was God's tool to bring them back to the Israel of Moses. You know, back to the true.
I just see Samuel
faith.
As yeah. the key character.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
More
absolutely. Yes. Very, very definitely. So, another Nehemiah. Nehemiah is a giant figure. Because when the children of Israel came back from the Babylonian captivity, they had nothing. They were a tiny, small group of people. There was no temple of the Lord. Nehemiah did two things. He rallied the people, and he pulled together the division that is already arising in the days of David between Judah and Israel. And there was the divided kingdom. The northern kingdom fell in 722, and 586, the southern kingdom, Judah, fell. Nehemiah welcomed back all the people that were Israelites of the northern kingdom and united them so that by the time of Jesus, there isn't Judah and Israel. Judah or Jacob and Israel is just the name for Israel. And that's Nehemiah. And he's kind of a minor character. But he was very, very important in a very critical time when Israel could simply have disappeared. It's just, you know, because they were so small. Yes?
Another quick question. You'd think after their first king, Saul, was such a failure, you know, these people wanted a king to be like the other kings, and Saul even attempted to do that. It ended up that way, ended up like the other kings.
So you'd think what?
Huh?
So you'd think what?
Why would they want more kings? Let's go back to the Judges.
You'd think after 2,000 years in the New Testament of God's people constantly chasing after the world, that we would have all learned. This depending on the Lord, it seems obvious to us. David gets the ephod. He asks the Lord what's going to happen. The Lord tells him, and he follows through on it. Well, why didn't everybody do that? Because it takes faith. Faith is the substance of things not seen. Armies are much more reliable. Just ask anyone.
But from the Israelite perspective, Saul was a successful king.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he conquered enemies.
The chronicler doesn't dwell on that, does he? When we read Samuel, the chronicler tells us that Saul was an utter failure. And he keeps at it. Well, we get to the end here. Let the man alone, you know. But the chronicler only has one interest. Are you doing what is the Lord's will or aren't you? And if you don't, you're out of luck. Utterly out of luck. So there you are. And David, despite his failures, what's he doing in Ziklag? You know, I mean, we don't know. It doesn't make sense. And then later on, there's all kinds of things that David does that that are really bad. One, of course, is Bathsheba. The other one is toward the end of Samuel. What does he do? Does anyone remember? He counts the troops. He counts the troops, and yet we'll look at that. So David is getting away from what was the heart of his, and that was very bad. That was, the Lord was not happy with that at all. So yes.
Well, yeah, I'm just curious. Was there more than one ephod?
No.
Then I thought Saul had the ephod. How did David?
During all of Judges, and during the time of Samuel and Saul. The tabernacle and the ephod just keep appearing. And if you try and sit down and try and figure out where it is, all you got is the chronicler saying that it was there or that the priest brought it. The tabernacle, what happened with the tabernacle? The children of Israel should have been worshiping at the tabernacle, but they're worshiping in the high places. Elijah is a faithful servant of the Lord, isn't he? Prophet of the Lord. Well, why isn't he at Jerusalem? Instead, he has an offering on a high mountain. When God deals with his people, whether it's Israel or St. Mark's or me, he has to hold his nose. It's just the way it is. This, the whole polygamy, you know, over and over again. And in the worship life, the same thing is true. Yes?
Back to the kingship, wasn't it sort of a thing that when they chose to have a king, it was sort of like to God, it's like he's going to establish it for on and on and on?
You mean the reign or the house of David or whatever it may be? Sure, that's what they wanted. That's why you would kill everybody who was a a descendant of anyone when you took over. When we get to the divided kingdom after Solomon, we're going to see that happen repeatedly.
But did God look at it as sort of a, you want a king, and sort of it's going to be something that continues on. And he's, because he goes ahead and he establishes David as king.
Forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's mixed things. God says to Israel, God says to Samuel, let him have a king. Samuel says, you can't have a king. What is this? You know, you're unhappy with God ruling over you? You want a king? You can't have a king. Forget that. And then he goes to ask the Lord what he should do, and the Lord says, give him a king. This is the other thing. We always have to keep in mind the chronicler's point of view. What is he going at? So you have to have a broad view. See where he's going. Don't get caught up in one little story and say, well, why is this and what the witch at Endor? As an example. It's interesting, but the chronicler is not going to tell us anything. It's just that that's not his interest. And the same with the Lord. Get bigger than Samuel. This whole thing is heading toward Jesus Christ. So that's why it seems that God says to Samuel, let him have a king. Because Jesus is prophet, priest, and king. Actually, in order, priest, king, prophet. And that's the priest first with the ephod, then the king. That fails, then the prophets. And they're not all neatly, but the time of the prophets is when the kings fail. Then it's Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Elisha, Elijah, all the Obadiah, the prophets of the Lord. So God is heading toward Christ, and everything has to be seen in that regard. That's why we're learning about Jesus when we're studying Samuel. All right, 2 Samuel. After the death of Saul, David returned from defeating the Amalekites and stayed at Ziklag 2 days. On the third day, a man arrived from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and with dust on his head. When he came to David, he fell to the ground to pay him honor. Where have you come from? David asked him. He answered, I have escaped from the Israelite camp. Escaped from the Israelite camp? David says, what happened? David asked, tell me. He said, the men fled from the battle. Many of them fell and died, and Saul and his son Jonathan are dead. Then David said to the young man who brought him the report, how do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead? I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, the young man said, and there was Saul leaning on his spear with the chariots and riders almost upon him. When he turned around and saw me, he called out to me, and I said, what can I do? He asked me, who are you? An Amalekite, I answered. Then he said to me, stand over me and kill me. I am in the throes of death, but I'm still alive. I'm dying, but I'm still alive. So I stood over him and killed him, because I knew that after he had fallen, he could not survive. And I took the crown that was on his head and the band on his arm and have brought them here to my Lord. Ooh, all right. Then David and all the men with him took hold of their clothes and tore them. They're still very demonstrative in the Middle East, expressing their feelings. No stiff upper lips. They mourned and wept and fasted till evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the army of the Lord and the house of Israel because they had fallen by the sword. David said to the young man who brought him the report, where are you from? I am the son of an alien, an Amalekite, he answered. David asked him, why were you not afraid to lift your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? Why were you not afraid? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And so David, I imagine with this question, the Amalekite is breaking out in a cold sweat. Why were you not afraid to lift your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? He didn't. I don't know if David knew that. I think we should say David didn't know that at this point. But the chronicler tells us that this Amalekite didn't kill Saul. Saul killed himself. So he's made up this story, and he came upon the dead body, apparently, grabbed the crown, and this must be some sort of decorative thing on his arm. There's no description of it, but evidence that it's the King David would recognize it as belonging to Saul. And so he says, boy, here's a real opportunity. I'm going to go. And maybe he knows about what Saul said, you know, because he tells a story that is really the same as what happened. He asked his armor bearer to kill him, but the armor bearer couldn't do it. So maybe this Amalekite heard this, because all he does is substitute himself for the story, and he thinks, well, this is going to work out perfectly. And maybe he was there. Well, he was there in some way. Whether he was right there all the time, that can't be told. But he thinks he can get away with this.
Pastor?
Yes?
He's got the crown.
Yeah.
He's taken the crown to David.
Yeah, yeah. So he was there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But exactly what, I mean, you know, you can't tell exactly. All he's done is take the story of Saul's death and put himself into it instead of Saul killing himself. And maybe he thinks nobody knows that. But it doesn't make any difference to David. You did what? You know. Then David called one of his men and said, go strike him down. So he struck him down and he died. For David had said to him, your blood be on your own head. Your own mouth testified against you when you said, I kill the Lord's anointed.
But he didn't.
No, it doesn't make any difference, though. David doesn't know that.
Yeah.
So he's killed for his lie, you know. Now, here again, here comes the chronicler. David is a man after God's own heart. The next thing is, you can imagine David's men saying, Saul is dead. We've got to start organizing. You know, we've got to get going. But that's not what David does. What does he do? What a soldier. He writes a psalm. He writes a poem. Yes?
I just don't understand what the Amalekite, whatever it is. I don't understand why he would say that he killed Saul. I mean, what, David didn't kill Saul. Why would he think that would be such a good thing that he would say he killed him? I mean, what?
Well, because he's an Amalekite, and because he would think, he knows from the outside that Saul has been pursuing David.
Mm-hmm.
So he wants, now David is going to be king, or he thinks that he's going to be king with good reason. And so he wants to get in on the good side of David, and so he's going to say, I killed him.
Well, basically what he's telling David is, I put him out of his misery, which is kudos to me, you know. But David didn't realize that God's the only one that could.
That's not what he said. He didn't say,
I killed him.
Yeah, he said, I killed him.
Well, but.
He's already dying.
Yeah, but that's, I can't remember, I can't quote the words, got to look back.
He's already dying.
Yeah.
You're right.
Why, yes. Okay. So he thinks that David is going to appreciate what he did.
Right.
Right.
Oh, good. Let him answer the question.
David took up this, yes, somebody has to do it. David took up this lament concerning Saul and his son Jonathan and ordered that the men of Judah be taught this lament of the bow. It is written in the book of Jashar. Jashar is it's one of those mysterious. There were writings that the children of Israel had that didn't become part of the sacred scriptures. This is a song. It's the song of the bow. Why would he call it the song of the bow? Can we guess, just looking? Because that was...
The thing that struck Saul.
Yeah, that's true. The archers were after him, but more...
Oh, I thought you were going to say that, the archers killed Saul.
Well, yeah, but it was Jonathan's weapon. Jonathan was an archer. So now, maybe David wrote this song. I mean, he was musical. Or maybe there was a tune called the Song of the Bow to which David now puts a poem. It doesn't make any difference. There's no way to tell that. This is so interesting. Godly grief. David should have turned his attention to becoming king. That would be the normal human thing to do. Saul is dead. Long live the new king. And there's all kinds of things to do. Instead, David sits down. I'm sure there were people who were frustrated by that. And he writes this lament. Yes.
Is any of this psalm in the book of Psalms?
No. Okay. Well, there are kind of parallel ideas. But like we're going to talk about the vultures later on. You can translate that vulture or eagle. There's not two words. It's kind of interesting. And he will bear you up on vulture's wings. Or your strength is renewed like the eagle's. Well, an eagle isn't actually, eagles don't fly like that. Vultures are the ones that are up there and they fly for hours and hours. You renew your strength. They just had one word for birds that ate stuff. So eagle is better than vulture, you know. All right. But it's interesting too. Another thing is we love the songs of praise. Laments? Oh my goodness, this song is in a minor key. We need upbeat music. You know, there are many laments in the book of Psalms, and there's a whole book of Lamentations. America likes winners, not losers. You know, here's losers. So let's look at this story, this lament of the bow. It's up to the editors. I would have capitalized it. I think it's a title. It is written in the book of Jashar. That's capitalized. Well, it's the lament of the bow. But it doesn't make any difference. Your glory, O Israel, lies slain on your heights, the mountains of Gilboa. So the glory of the Lord is in her army and in her king. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. You know, they're singing glory to Dagon. Lest the daughters of the Philistines be glad, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised rejoice. What did the daughters of the Israelites say? Sing.
Saul has killed his thousands and David
his 10,000. So the women sing the songs of praises, and lest the daughters of the Philistines be glad. O mountains of Gilboa, may you have neither dew nor rain, nor fields that yield offerings of grain. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul no longer rubbed with oil. They made their shields out of tough skin, and when you prepared for a battle, you oiled the shields so that they would not shatter when struck with a blow. They would absorb it. So the shield of Saul is no longer rubbed with oil. And so this is a song of pain, isn't it? Obviously, in some objective sense, David does not want a grain to no longer grow on Mount Gilboa, but it's just a way of expressing great sorrow. The shield of Saul is no longer rubbed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the flesh of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back. So Jonathan never wasn't a coward. He fought valiantly. The sword of Saul did not return unsatisfied. So Philistia won, but at great cost. Saul, there's no reason to believe that, it's just that time, so we better pause there. There is no reason to believe that David wrote this lament at the moment that they killed this Amalekite. The chronicler is not interested in chronology. He just wants to tell us that this was important to David, the loss of Jonathan and even the loss of Saul and the defeat of Israel. So let's pick it up with verse 23. and we'll continue on in 2 Samuel. Yeah, oh yes, that's right. Next week is...